You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 193 by Rudolf Steiner. 10 lectures, entitled Problems of Society, An Esoteric View, From Luciferic Past to Ahrimanic Future. Lecture 6, given in Berlin on the 12th of September, 1919. Today, the first time I have spoken to you about anthroposophic matters here in this space, I wish, first of all, to express my gratitude to the friends who, while I was away from Berlin, put such devoted effort into preparing these premises to serve our anthroposophic reflections and work. We live in a time when the human soul must engage with great encompassing events in the cosmos and in human evolution. If we seek to fully understand our place as human beings in the world, these great, far-reaching events require our keen will to such an extent that we cannot so easily attend to outer beauty, such as the furnishing of these rooms, as perhaps we did in former, calmer, or at least seemingly calmer times. These rooms are to be dedicated to ideal goals, spiritual goals, and here people can work together socially and communally. But if we reflect a little, we can see that there is a certain connection between the great events pulsing through the world today and premises such as these. The significant demands which human history and evolution now make upon us will, after all, increasingly tend toward the transformation of a past aesthetic, in which human beings sought beauty in and for their own private and egoistic enjoyment, toward spaces and dimensions in which they collaborate socially. We do not properly judge the future aims seeking to unfold in human evolution if we see them in terms of the cultural phenomena sometimes apparently surfacing today. The social movement of today bears apparently a, quote, more democratic, close quote, character, though we need only grasp its transient nature to discern what is inherent in this movement and recognize its true characteristics. At the same time, this movement also bears in it something that could strike alarm into us. It seems that the aesthetic beauty, the art, which is such a part of our earthly culture, will not meet in future with the same understanding as in the past when materially prosperous circles had the luxury of devoting themselves to the pursuit of beauty. A time of transition may lead to aesthetic sensitivity receding somewhat. But precisely when our life assumes more social forms and dimensions, it will be indispensable that outward spatial forms are aesthetically informed by the character and needs of the times, for otherwise humanity would succumb to Philistine banality. Thus the simple beauty in which our friends sought to express the serious tenor of matters to be aired here in future is something we can see as symbolic of the great events that pulse through our times. And I believe I speak for all of you when with such feelings I offer my warmest thanks at this grave time for the work our friends have accomplished here. It would also be wrong to believe that developments in preparation today are such that, in quotes, objective events in the world might lead to a diminution of the value of individual personal attributes and all that originates in them. This is not so. It is only during the centuries, up to the end of the 19th, the last 3 to 4 centuries, that it has appeared justified in terms of overall human evolution to see the human being as a cog in the universal mechanism. In the near future, it will be a human task to work our way out of this universal mechanism again. And therefore we can certainly say that the great movement of the present day has a mostly egoistic character, is thoroughly egoistic. Yes, people strive for socialism, but they do so out of entirely anti-social drives and instincts. We should not overlook this, that today we strive for socialism, basically because people have grown so inwardly anti-social. If the social instincts were more self-evident, we would not need so many social programs, which have arisen only as a reaction to our anti-social feelings. But precisely in such an era, when things remain so muddled and unclear, when a social element is seeking to be born out of egoism and antisocial instincts, a very particular effect emanates from what has been accomplished through noble, selfless dedication to an ideal, sustained by authentic, true, unegoistic human feelings. And it will be good if we celebrate this in a sense, though not in an external way, by turning our thoughts in these grave times to an appreciation of what I have just expressed, to the great value of finding, alongside the rampant egoism of our time, a means to create what has been created here, albeit in very limited scope, in the form of ideal spiritual work. Today, it seems to me that the most festive means of celebrating this is to engage in reflections which address the seriousness of the times, on the one hand, so that the sense of seriousness can invoke feelings in our soul that accompany us in the work to be undertaken here in these rooms, for as long as these times continue to allow this work here, and, on the other, to keep allowing thoughts to work upon us, which, because so intimately connected with humanity's evolution, can be worthy of our inner contemplation, whenever we enter these premises to fulfill the tasks that they aim to serve. If we give critical attention to our time, but not critical in a disparaging sense, we cannot help but see, if we are honest, the numerous signs and currents of decline apparent in every sphere of life. If we are not to lose our sense of seriousness, we must not forget what a gulf commonly exists between the usual content of people's awareness, to which they give verbal expression, and all that is inwardly true and real. Broad swathes of the population today have lost any sense or feeling that the words we speak are so often far removed from the truth. An elemental outflow of truth from the human soul has, one can say, been replaced by generalized phrases. Empty phrases are best characterized as speech not inwardly connected with the source of truth. And the connection can, after all, only be an inward one. We need only consider the manifestations of general untruth that have surfaced in the world over the past 4 or 5 years. And we will see, beyond doubt, that in departing so generally from authentic reality, people have instead come to express themselves in empty phrases, in formulaic utterances. If nothing were to counteract this, the trend would keep increasing. In modern times, along with such phrase-mongering, great indulgence has developed toward this untruthfulness, a kind of easy tolerance of it and inclination for it. Wherever people speak empty phrases, you find also a great tolerance of it and of the untruth it embodies. Those who tolerate it so easily ascribe the best intentions to those who speak it, and there is very little conscientious sense of truth which would require someone who opens his mouth to examine the basis of what he says and to refrain from speaking until he has done so. The time must come when it is no longer sufficient to say that someone who says something untrue is well-meaning. We must instead develop a very sharp sense of responsibility toward the truth, toward testing and verifying it, realizing that we should not merely be lenient with ourselves when we discover that something we said in good faith does not correspond to reality. We need to realize that as far as objective knowledge of the world is concerned, our subjective belief that we have spoken the truth is not what counts, and that for this objective world knowledge, it does indeed matter whether we say something objectively true that corresponds to reality, or something that is not and does not. Specifically, because of these grave times, we will have to learn the difference between true utterance and empty phrase. Nowadays, though, they are not fully conscious of this. People have a feeling that they can say whatever they feel like. You can see this, and I have studied it, in the stance people take toward contemporary events. We have overlooked things of great seriousness, which people judge only as they are inclined to, rather than according to the real significance of these events for humanity's whole evolution. In our midst have been figures directly involved in and responsible for what has happened over the past 4 to 5 years. People whom circumstances have placed in prime positions in relation to global events. The destiny of these people has now overtaken them, but very few are willing to seek an objective judgment of what has actually happened, to ask by what means, by what kinds of choice and selection, these leading figures secured their leading positions and wrought the disaster that they did. Nothing is more important today than to wrestle our way through all subjective opinions, to find a certain objectivity in respect of these things. Many people think it is an easy matter today to speak the truth. It is not easy, since truth has so many enemies, and because those who do speak it are quickly marginalized. You will often court disfavor if you speak the truth today. In recent months, when it was so often said to me that the ideas I expressed about society were so hard to comprehend, that people could not grasp what I meant, I repeatedly countered this by saying that comprehension of this social impulse required a different mood of soul than that prevailing in Central Europe over the past 4 or 5 years, or culminating then and in fact already present long before. Over these 4 to 5 years, people have understood a great deal, have understood things that I certainly did not understand. Many figures have made all sorts of statements and declamations, beautifully couched and framed, but an honest sense of truth could make nothing of them, though people seemed to comprehend them. They did so because they were ordered to. When orders came from the HQ of war operations, they understood them. But now, we need to understand things that we are not commanded to, that we grasp by our own free inner capacities. Perhaps people have now lost the habit of this and will have to reacquire it. The past 4 or 5 years have truly shown that these capacities are lacking and must be regained. Habits that have developed in recent years oblige us to counter them with the truth. And this is no pleasant duty, firstly, because the truth is a serious matter, and secondly, because you are often much frowned on for speaking it. There will come a time when people look back on these times of ours in a very particular way. Our obligations have altered from what they were only quite recently, and therefore one now has to give people an idea of how future times will judge what is occurring now. They will have to learn to turn their gaze, their spiritual gaze, once more to the great shifts occurring, to the great developmental impulses now affecting humanity on the earth. One such transformative impulse began in the mid-15th century. And we refer to this in our anthroposophic spiritual science as the beginning of the fifth post-Atlantean epoch. We know that this is quite different in character from the former Greco-Roman epoch, which began in the 8th century BC and ended in the 15th century AD. Immersed in the fable convenu that people call history, they do not discern the huge difference in the mood of the human soul between, say, the 10th century and the centuries that began around the middle of the 15th. New outlooks, a new atmosphere of soul, came upon humanity then. And we can only really understand these developments and transformations if we turn our inner gaze upward to the powers that hold sway in humanity, which, for instance, played into these upheavals and new impulses in the middle of the 15th century. In our own time, now that several centuries have passed since the mid-15th century, what broke over human civilization back then has in a sense culminated in a crisis. It slowly developed until our own time, reaching a decisive point today, a key moment that human consciousness must grasp. We have reached a point when human beings must become aware. How they will do this is something we will speak further of. That they stand here within earthly occurrences, and besides them, there are three realms of nature, the animal, plant, and mineral kingdoms. But in acknowledging this from the perspective of modern consciousness of the fifth post-Atlantean epoch, we state only half the truth. People living before this epoch spoke the whole truth when they said this, since they understood things differently. They saw spirit at work in these animal, plant, and mineral kingdoms, whereas people today have lost this awareness. They must regain it by developing the insight that just as they are connected with the three kingdoms below them, so also they are connected above them with the three realms of the Angeloi, Arcangeloi and Archai. Just as our physical body has a certain relationship with the animal, plant, and mineral kingdoms, so our soul and spirit are related to the nature of these three heavenly hierarchies. A time has arrived when, just as our relationship with the three natural kingdoms has undergone great changes, so we are, likewise, changing our relationship with the three realms of the hierarchies above us. Today I want to speak to you about this serious aspect of humanity's evolution, acknowledgement of which is the most fitting and festive way to celebrate the inauguration of these new premises. If we look back to what happened in human evolution in previous epochs, ending around the middle of the 15th century, and for now leaving higher hierarchies to one side, we have to say that the beings of the Angeloi, Arcangeloi, and the Archai have always been preoccupied with the human being, in so far as he passes through an existence between death and a new birth, and also an existence between birth and death, here on the earthly plane. But in our era, this preoccupation of the beings of these three hierarchies with the human being, in a sense, came to a conclusion. The manifold activities which the beings of these three hierarchies were obliged to undertake included this: to collaborate on the image underlying the physical human being on earth, his physical organization. At birth, we enter upon physical existence and grow within earthly conditions, a process during which the image of humanity, of humankind, comes to expression in us. In ancient times, this human image was very different and has undergone much change. You need only remember what emerges when we look back to ancient Atlantean times, or even just back to Egyptian culture. People were different in their outward form and structure. The image of the human being has changed, and the task of the beings of these three higher hierarchies was to work upon it. Their tasks included elaborating this image, developing it from what it was in ancient Lemuria, then Atlantis, through to what it became in the various post-Atlantean epochs. Thus the beings of these three hierarchies gradually created the image that now underlies the earthly human being through transformation from more ancient images. But here we come to the remarkable thing, revealed to a truly spiritual observation of human evolution. In our age, these three hierarchies have now largely concluded the fundamental development of this human image. Insofar as it underlies the human physical organism, this image of humankind is finished and complete. Try to gain a feeling for this significant fact. The beings of the hierarchies, the Angeloi, the Archangeloi, and Archai, have worked upon the human image through many, many millennia. And this image is the foundation and pattern, if you like, of our human physical organization. And now we live in an age when these beings of the three higher hierarchies say to themselves, quote, "We have worked upon the image of humankind, but now this work is done. We have placed the human being into this earthly world as physical entity, and this work is now finished." Close quote. In studying this fact through spiritual vision, we can be struck and shaken to discover that the interest of the beings of these three higher hierarchies in creating this physical image has not only lessened in our age, but disappeared entirely. If we look back to the Greco-Roman period, these beings of the higher hierarchies still had a lively interest in creating this image of the physical human being on earth, whereas now their interest is gone. Their feeling is that they have done their part on behalf of the physical human being on earth, and from this perspective, their interest has faded altogether. We human beings can regard this as an especially significant fact with decisive effects on human nature. To realize its scope, people need only take the time and leisure to observe the outward characteristics of humankind's evolution. If we look back to former times, we can tell from much that has occurred and has been passed down to us that certain thoughts surfaced instinctively in people of earlier times. Those in whom certain thoughts surface instinctively in this way are regarded as geniuses. Or at least it is believed that this happens still today. But there is little of genius left in human beings on earth. You see, the forces of genius no longer surface from the body's organism, since the beings of the three higher hierarchies no longer work upon this organism. They have lost interest in the corporeal form of the human being. In certain respects, the fact that the form of the human body is now finished renders modern human beings arrogant. Throughout the rest of earthly evolution, we will no longer perfect our physical earthly form. No further perfecting of our organism will occur in corporeal terms. What once surfaced instinctively in the traits of genius in the human soul arose from the body, and at the same time, because it was the work of gods, exerted an organizing effect on the body. When Homer created his epics, for instance, his poetry drew on a power which in the ancient Greeks was at the same time an organizing power that shaped and configured the Greek body. Emerging with tangible force and momentum, this simultaneously had body-forming powers. By contrast, the laws of nature we deduce today, of which we are so proud, are largely abstractions and have no power to shape and configure the body. We, therefore, form abstract thoughts, that are unable to exert a mastering influence on society and abstract laws of nature. And this is because the beings of the three higher hierarchies no longer work upon us, and therefore thoughts with organizing power no longer surface within us. Our being of soul has grown abstract. The soul within our body has been forsaken by the activity, the work of the beings of the three higher hierarchies. And here we come to the important thing, that we must now seek through our own resources to connect again with the work of the beings of the three higher hierarchies. Hitherto, these beings came toward us, worked upon us. Now, we ourselves must work upon our own soul and spirit. And the soul spiritual work we accomplish, what we reveal of the world of spirit through spiritual scientific research, will become in our human soul something that rekindles the interest of these hierarchical beings. They will be in the thoughts and feelings we draw from the world of spirit. And by this means, we will again forge a connection with the beings of the hierarchies. That is the degree of significance of what is happening today. We must see it as a change in the relationship between the world of gods and humankind. Until our own times, gods worked in to perfect the physical human image, and now human beings must start to work upon the content of their soul, so that they find a way back to the three higher hierarchies. One of the great difficulties of our age is that people are so proud of their now perfected external corporeal image, and develop abstract thoughts independently of it, that is, independently of any higher world. These thoughts have no connection with the world of spirit. And yet our proper task now is really to seek this connection by our own resources, through dedication to spiritual knowledge, through feelings about spiritual knowledge, and by drawing our impulses of will from spiritual knowledge. Only through a full feeling awareness of this great change in evolution, though it takes place over centuries, can one find the right outlook in our era. We cannot find our place in this era through merely external reflections, but must find the way to acquire it through inner work upon ourselves. You see, we have entered the age of the consciousness soul, leaving behind us the age of the rational or mind-soul which informed the Greco-Roman era. And this consciousness soul must increasingly develop in such a way that the beings of the higher hierarchies no longer work into us, for this would darken our awareness. But instead we must consciously elevate ourselves to them. Our fully aware, bright, clear day consciousness will be composed of this effort of self-elevation to the higher hierarchies. Spiritual science is the beginning of these endeavors. It does not originate in anything arbitrary, but arises from insight into the radical changes at work in our time. But there are various other things, too, that we must consciously develop. Humankind has always had to live according to the laws of karma, the great laws of destiny, but has not always been aware of these. Lessing's title, Education of the Human Race, took the world by surprise when it appeared as if fully formed from modern culture and brought with it an awareness of repeated lives on earth. The time is now beginning, when we cannot any longer interact and live with each other as in past eras. We have already seen that we cannot have the same relationship as we once did to the three higher hierarchies. But the same is true of our relationships with other human beings. The life humankind once led continues to influence us today. But we neglect our duties to the modern age if we do not emphasize the need for a new form of relationship between people. So far this did not matter, since human consciousness was not obliged to take itself in hand in the past. And in former times people related to each other without knowing that a soul lives within us, which before its latest birth lived another life on earth. A time will come, and is dawning already, when it would be an inner flaw in us to be ignorant of something living in another person's soul that originates in a former life on earth. Until now it did not matter that people were unaware of this. But now a time begins when it should not be ignored. Let me illustrate this with an example. Among the social impulses we sought to develop was a school founded in a really new human spirit. The Waldorf School, affiliated for the time being with the Waldorf Astoria cigarette factory. Last Sunday we celebrated its opening, preceded by a seminar that I gave for teachers. Here the primary emphasis was on founding a pedagogy, an art of education and teaching which takes full account that within the child is developing a soul originating in a former life on earth. Hitherto, teachers, even very progressive ones, saw their task as developing certain emergent skills and capacities from the child's soul, and yet they could only see, more or less, what could be drawn forth from the body of the child. This will not be sufficient in future for fulfilling the teacher's profession. Instead, a teacher will have to have a fine sense of what is emerging in the growing child from former lives on earth. And this will be a radical change in the education of the future, using this insight to draw out of the child what needs to be developed. But before this can happen, social conditions must arise that are founded on our spiritual relationship with other people. An awareness that a resurrected soul, in a sense, is there before you, in another human being, and originates in a previous incarnation. It is not enough to possess this as theoretical knowledge only, a kind of conceptual worldview, but it must also become practical, so much so that it forms the sound basis for an art of education, an art of teaching. That is what makes this approach a living and life-enhancing one. And it is therefore self-evident that there is as yet little receptivity for such things, and that people look askance at those with a spiritual outlook who perceive what is needed today. What is needed, rather, than the trumpeting of certain spiritual worldviews, is to cast the sunlight of knowledge upon specific and tangible areas of life. It is not about formulaic utterances, but about implementing such knowledge in the very life of humanity. In founding a new pedagogy, we discern very clearly how the past, with its empty phrases, collides with a new age. I have taken pains to inform myself thoroughly about modern educational approaches. Often, I will give only one example here, people ask whether the form or content of education is more important. Should we educate people with certain professions in view, so that they find their proper place in civil life? Or should we pay more attention to human nature itself, drawing out of children more generally human attributes in a humanistic approach? There has been much debate about this in educational circles, but this is only phrase-mongering, since there is such divergence here between what people say and any inwardly comprehended truth. Are people anything other than the conditions they grow into? Take modern civil servants as an example. By what means are they dedicated to public office? By the fact that past generations established this or that institution. Public life today is only the outcome of what earlier generations created. Is this why teachers of the past focused on the content of education rather than the manner of delivering it? It is true that they did so, and yet the two approaches are one and the same. And so the debates that rage are about things that amount to the same thing. Something else is important. That, in the children born today, we find the tendencies and inclinations that will develop and mature in the next generation and the one after that. That, in other words, we are educating for the future. Whether we teach people with an emphasis on content or form, the latter being seen as humanistic, is mere phrase. But that we must educate for the future, must predict and prefigure the tasks of coming generations, is a serious and important matter, and intrinsic to the life of the world. People today say such things are hard to grasp, but they will have to get used to grasping them, since otherwise, increasingly, modern developments will leave them stranded. This is really extremely important. We have to become more aware, in the fullest and most serious sense, both because we must find a connection with the work of the beings of the higher hierarchies, and also because a new kind of relationship is necessary between people themselves in the field of education. In every person who stands before us, every child, we must nurture not just the present soul, but the one who has emerged from former conditions on earth. This is something we must remain continually aware of. It is so important that we find a real, tangible relationship to the spirit. Just knowing something about karma, about recurring lives on earth, about the human constitution, is fine as theoretical knowledge, as a world view, but this will not get us very far in itself. Only when this theoretical world view comes alive does it become what humanity needs in the immediate future. To these two truths, about our relationship to the higher hierarchies and about karma, we can add a third. From my account in Title Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, you will know that when a person comes to perceive the world of spirit, he inevitably has an experience referred to as the crossing of the threshold. I describe this crossing of the threshold in terms of the three human soul faculties, which in physical life interact in a fairly chaotic manner, separating and becoming autonomous, the power of thinking, feeling, and will. As a person crosses the threshold, these powers become independent of each other. In many respects, the whole course of humanity's evolution resembles the life of an individual human being, although things are transposed. What we undergo consciously when we seek to perceive in the world of spirit, the so-called crossing of the threshold, is something that all humanity has to pass through during this fifth post-Atlantean epoch. There is no choice about this. Humankind is passing through this experience unconsciously. Not the individual, but all humanity, and each individual with humanity. What does this mean? In future, our thinking, feeling, and will that presently interact and work together in us will become sundered. And this is already becoming apparent in various domains. Humanity is in the process of passing unconsciously through a significant doorway that is clearly perceived by the seer. In this transition, over the threshold, the realms of thinking, feeling, and will diverge. But this obliges us to shape external life in a way that allows the human being to undergo this radical inner change in his outward life as well. As thinking in the life of humankind becomes more autonomous, we must establish a foundation on which it can unfold and develop in a sounder way. And the same is true for feeling and for will. the chaotically interwoven fabric of public life, as it has been until now, must be divided into three spheres: economic life, the life of rights or the political state, and cultural or spiritual life. This demand for social threefolding is connected with the secret of humanity's evolution in our era. Please do not think that this threefold social organism is an arbitrary invention. It is born from the most intimate perception of humanity's evolution, and from what must happen if the aims of this evolution are not to be thwarted. We have suffered the terrible catastrophe of the World War in recent years because people found it so hard to discern a goal of a spiritual nature, and were so far removed from even acknowledging that such goals exist. We must now work our way out of such chaos, as the very course of humanity's evolution itself dictates. However, it seems to me that the need for social threefolding will only be thoroughly understood on an anthroposophic basis, through feeling and awareness of what is actually happening in our evolution. In our day, people dislike acknowledging such things. They much prefer dealing with immediate, short-term issues, rather than delving into the deeper secrets of existence. Someone who gazes into these secrets is much saddened by this, finding humanity so completely disinclined to engage from what is most needed. But there is much more to be said. All pessimism is wrong. This does not mean that all optimism is right either, of course. But appealing to the will is certainly right. We should will and seek to realize what accords with humanity's rightful evolution. And in doing so, we have to remind ourselves continually that the old era is past, and we must draw a line under it. We can only gain true insights today if we draw a line under a past age, and can only count on a new era by making a spiritual reckoning. We should not deceive ourselves that we can carry forward into the new era what we have become so comfortable and familiar with in a past one, but instead must begin to turn to effective new ideas in outward life. Humanity stands at a crossroads. One path leads through mechanization of the mind and spirit, which has become very mechanical in modern times, especially in abstract laws of nature, which have then also been applied wholesale to the life of society. Mechanization of the spirit means a vegetating soul. Vegetables sleep, and the human soul also inclines to sleep. People are sleepwalking through the most important events. It is true to say, indeed, that people have slept through the most important events of recent years, and they continue to do so now. Standing where I do today, I want to say this, that the people of Central Europe have allowed leading figures to speak untruths to them day after day and are continuing in this blindness without being aware of it. People see that the mark has fallen on the currency exchange to 2.15 centimes. But I haven't yet found a single person who understands the relationship between the falling currency market and other events of pressing importance. A word of three syllables, I won't tell you what it is right now, will give you the answer to why the value of the mark is falling. But souls love to sleep so much that we allowed a great disappointment to come over us in Central Europe, one to which, as you might say, people were looking forward beforehand. It was thought that when women get the vote in parliamentary elections, things will be twice as reasonable as before. But then came the National Assembly, and we found that this doubling of common sense, compared to the old German parliament, was nowhere in evidence. Instead, the old parties continued, perpetuated old ways, at a time when these parties should have vanished lock, stock, and barrel. People have no clue what this means, since souls are sleeping. Mechanization of the spirit, vegetation of souls. And if we look eastward, we see a very marked increase in the animalization of bodies. Just as Americanization of the spirit is tantamount to mechanization of culture, so the Bolshevism spreading in the East reveals an animalization of bodies. These people criticize this or that, condemn it out of their emotions, but they do not seek to grasp life's reality. And so humanity today faces a choice, either to move toward a mechanization of the mind and spirit, the vegetation of souls, the animalization of bodies, or, on the other hand, to try to find the path toward an awakening of the spirit, to find it in impulses that accord with the age of the consciousness soul and connect the human soul to the work and activity of the higher hierarchies. They can seek to acknowledge that the conscious human soul originates in former lives on earth, and that a threefold society is needed. These things belong together. And those who unite in the moment, we call anthroposophic spiritual science, should feel themselves to be a core, a kernel, from which emanates the strength for social renewal. True social reform can only emerge from spiritual impulses. And for this reason, we could have expected the best understanding for our social circumstances and conditions to come from those who belong to this movement. Here, then, in these new premises, we have spoken of some of the factors at work in modern life, along with pressing needs. I would like to think that this festive occasion will extend to an ongoing awareness, whenever we meet here, of these truths that are so vital to human evolution. The more we inform our anthroposophic work with such awareness, the more of a festive, sacred hue we lend to this work. And these premises will best be inaugurated through feelings we summon from such sources. The end of Lecture 6.